After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who has been born King of the Jews? We saw his star in the east and have come to worship him." When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. When he had called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them where the Christ, that is, the Messiah, was to be born. "In Bethlehem in Judea," they replied, "for this is what the prophet has written, quote, 'But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for out of you will come a ruler who will be the shepherd of my people Israel.' Then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, 'Go, make a careful search for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me, so that I too may go and worship him.' After they had heard the king, they went on their way, and the star they had seen in the east went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshiped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold and incense and of myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. When they had gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. 'Get up,' he said, 'take the child and his mother and escape to Egypt. Stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to kill him.' So he got up, took the child and his mother during the night and left for Egypt, where he stayed until the death of Herod. And so was fulfilled what the Lord had said through the prophet, 'Out of Egypt I called my son.' When Herod realized that he had been outwitted by the Magi, he was furious, and he gave orders to kill all the boys in Bethlehem and its vicinity who were 2 years old and under, in accordance with the time he had learned from the Magi. Then what was said through the prophet Jeremiah was fulfilled. 'A voice is heard in Ramah, weeping and great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children and refusing to be comforted because they are no more.'" There are a lot of interesting things in this chapter that we are not going to focus on today. We are not going to focus primarily on the wise men, although we will have to look at them. We are not going to discuss this marvelous star, what it was and how it got there, although that's an interesting fact. And we're not primarily going to discuss or focus upon Mary and Joseph and the child fleeing into Egypt, although that was certainly a result of what we're going to discuss. What we are going to look at this morning is Herod's strange and troubled response to this whole situation. Because everyone else in the whole Christmas story was positive about the birth of this baby. The angels were positive about it. The shepherds were overjoyed at it. Mary and Joseph were in awe. Wise men came and worshipped him. Bethlehem inhabitants, it said, marveled at the child. The old man, Simeon, and the aged prophetess, Anna, both were highly impressed with the child. But there was only one man in the entire Christmas story who was troubled by it. Herod the Great. And unless you think that perhaps this doesn't have anything to do with you because you're not a king, nor do you feel particularly anxious to murder little babies on Christmas Eve, I would like to suggest to you that it's possible that there are more parallels between King Herod and us in this room than maybe we would like to think. So look at it with me, will you? First, I think it's important to know exactly who was this Herod the Great, Herod the King, who was spoken of in Matthew chapter 2. In 63 BC, the Roman Empire conquered Palestine. And by 47 BC, the rulers they had set up were having so much trouble keeping the quiet, keeping the peace, and were fighting among themselves that the Romans took a non-Israelite, an Edomite, that is a man from Edom, which is to the south and east of Jerusalem, and made him king over Israel. Actually, he was a Roman procurator. This man was the father of Herod the Great. So, a non-Jew, a non-Israelite, was ruling over occupied Israel. 5 years later, as this gentleman died, his two sons became co-regents in Israel, Herod and his brother. Now, as it turns out, that while Herod and his brother were ruling Judea, the southern portion of Israel, that a foreign power known as the Parthians came and raided Israel. This happened in the 40s before Jesus Christ. As you can see, the time leading up to Christ's birth was not a very peaceful time. It was full of foreign occupation. Now, it so happened that when these foreign Parthians came and took over Israel and expelled the Romans, they set up a Jewish king over Israel. Not only was he Jewish, but he was from the most famous family of Jews that had ever lived in living memory of these people, a very popular man. Herod's brother was killed, and Herod himself fled to Rome. There he appealed to the Roman Senate, and the Roman Senate declared him to be king over Israel, king of the Jews. Herod was given an army of men to go back and recapture Israel in the name of Rome and to expel the Jewish king so that an Edomite king could rule and become king of the Jews. And that is what he did. He laid siege to Jerusalem for 3 months. Finally, it fell, and Herod, who had become known by this time as Herod the Great, became the Edomite ruler over Israel, and everyone hated him. They hated him because he slaughtered Israelites in order to wade through their blood to ascend to the throne to rule over them, and he had not a drop of Jewish blood in him. They hated him because of the way he treated the men who withstood him at the city walls during the siege. Now, once he became ruler over Israel, he became the most effective ruler Israel had known for a long time. He was an extremely efficient man. Bands of guerrilla soldiers who were roaming the countryside were wiped out within a matter of months. Opposition to the government, that is, the Jewish Roman government that he represented because he was a mere puppet of Rome, was stamped out mercilessly, quickly, and efficiently. There were two rabbis who encouraged students to tear down the Roman eagle that had been placed over the gate of the temple in Jerusalem. Herod had the two teachers and the 40 students gathered together and burned alive. He was an extraordinary orator. When he stood up to give a speech for the people, even though they hated him, they loved him because he was so good. He could make his soldiers go anywhere and do anything. He had a skill of Patton for rousing men to battle. And he was a diplomat. He was a diplomat's diplomat. Several times in his history of his rulership, he turned cards and made an about-face and allied himself with his former enemies in order to play his political cards correctly. For example, when the Roman Empire was being struggled for between Antony and Cleopatra on the one hand and Octavian on the other hand, Herod supported Antony and Cleopatra. It did not help matters any for him when Antony and Cleopatra committed suicide, and his side was obviously the ship that was going down. And so Herod went out to meet the incoming victor, Octavian, on the coast of Israel. Octavian later became Caesar Augustus. And Herod, rather than try to hide the fact that he was Antony's friend, just opened up his heart and said, "I was the friend of Antony. I served him with every ounce of strength in me. And, oh, great Augustus, I will serve you with every ounce of strength in me." And Augustus said, "Fine." And he reinstated Herod, and he gave him even more lands. Herod, by the way, had announced to one of his servants that if he came back dead, to please slit his wife's throat so that she would not outlive him. Herod was a great sponsor of athletic games in Jerusalem. Now, you might think that this is just the same thing as starting Little League in Jerusalem, but it's not, because we're talking about Greek games. We're talking about Greek games where, before the ceremonies, homage is done to the Roman Empire. Pagan gods are at least tacitly worshipped, and we are talking about the fact that the men usually exercise in the nude. This was not the kind of thing that pious and conservative Jews really went for in his day, and so Herod, everyone could tell, was the kind of man you really didn't want around if you were a conservative, religious, Jewish zealot. On the other hand, he made the Jewish people very happy because he was an extraordinary builder. Herod was one of the wonders of the ancient world himself in the buildings that he built. He built an amphitheater in the port of Caesarea in Israel that stands to this day and is marvelous. Herod built the temple in Jerusalem, which began in 19 BC and took until 63 AD to complete. and it was so magnificent. It was one of the wonders of the ancient world. Herod built buildings all over the Roman Empire. He himself financed and had designed and erected buildings in Antioch, Beirut, Damascus, Tyre, Sidon, Rhodes, and even in Athens. Now, does it give you a feel for this man? Extraordinarily capable, a good diplomat, very cunning, rather cruel, not a Jew, and yet frequently gave the Jews things that they really needed. Once during a famine in the land, Herod did this. There was no money left for food in Israel. And so he took all the gold from one of his palaces, beat it into coinage, took it to Egypt, and bought food for everyone. Personal expenses. Can you believe this? Herod did this. And so on the one hand, he was a marvelous man. But on the other hand, he would turn around and murder his best friend. Hard to really figure out the gentleman, isn't it? Now, who was Herod religiously? This man who ordered the young children in Bethlehem murdered. Well, Herod, although he was not a Jew, you must know that Edom, where he hailed from, had been conquered by the Jews within the past 150 years. And so Judaism had, in essence, been forced down the throats of the Edomites. So Herod was familiar with Judaism. He lived in Israel, and if there's ever a place where you're going to get religion, it's living in Israel. You're at the very spot where David killed Goliath. You're at the very spot where the great Israelite victories over the Philistines took place. You're at the very Valley of Armageddon, where Gideon swooped down from the hill and where marvelous battles took place. If you're going to get a sense of the Bible's history, Herod was right in the middle of it. Not only that, but Herod married a Jewish wife from this famous Israelite family that was the most famous and respected in the entire country. Now, incidentally, he had to divorce his first wife in order to do this, but that was no large thing to him. It was a political move. Miriam, this beautiful Jewish princess, was one of 10 wives that he eventually had. He had a nominal outward respect for the Bible and for religion. As I mentioned before, he built for the Jews the greatest temple they had ever seen, except for the time of Solomon. And he read the Bible when it was expedient to do so. For example, you'll notice in verse 4, when the Magi came to him, he called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, that is, all the ecclesiastical authorities, and he asked them where the Christ was to be born. In Bethlehem, Judea, they replied, for this is what the prophet has written, and they go on to quote the Old Testament prophet, Micah, in order to say where the Messiah is going to be born. So you see, Herod has this in common with very many people today. He himself is not particularly a religious man, but he has a spouse who is very religious. He himself is not particularly interested in the scriptures on a daily basis, but when it is expedient and interesting for him to search them, he does. As if, say, a person might be interested occasionally in wondering just what is in the book of Revelation and all those prophecies at the end of the world. And so we skip over the four Gospels and the story of Jesus, and we skip over the epistles and the writings of Paul, and we get to the real goodies in the book of Revelation and just flip through it, hoping that no one sees us, perhaps. Or perhaps his attitude to the scriptures is very much like the person who basically doesn't touch his Bible until he faces a financial crisis, or until there's a death in his family and he needs comfort, and so he opens to the book of Psalms to grasp at some soothing words. Perhaps he uses it like a person maybe who never reads the scriptures but at a wedding would use it to have an appropriate Bible verse. Find me some good verses on love we can put in the bulletin, that sort of thing. This is his approach to the scriptures. They were not part of his daily life, but when he needed them, they were there. Also, you must realize that his true feelings inside, although he had an outward veneer of respectability and appreciation for religion and for religious buildings and ceremonies, inside it says very clearly that when Herod heard about all this, he was disturbed. He was disturbed at this baby, and he was disturbed at these strange people who had come to worship him. And I would like to suggest to you, as we consider the baby that disturbed him and the people who came to worship him, that perhaps there are people in this room who feel the same kind of unsettledness in their souls about this whole Christmas season. The carols are fine and the decorations are fine, but this constant emphasis on Jesus Christ being God, etc., just might be disconcerting to you, and maybe you don't even know why. Perhaps this passage will help. Let's look at the baby and at the people who worship the baby, which are the two things that disturbed Herod. First, let's look at the baby. Who was this baby that disturbed him? Well, first was this. He knew that even though this child was just a baby, that there was something supernatural about this baby. He knew that because of this star. These people from the Far East, and we all know that people from the Far East are a little hard to penetrate their thinking anyway, don't we? These people from the Far East had seen, quote, his star rising in the east. Now, it is universally acknowledged that there was an unusual planetary lineup very close to the time of the birth of Jesus Christ. It is not known exactly when Jesus was born, although the best estimates are late in 5 BC, perhaps in October, November, or December, but it's not absolutely certain. What is absolutely certain is that very close to that time, there were unusual planetary lineups that commentaries go into great detail to describe, and those of you who are interested in astronomy, I'd be glad to show you the references and you can look them up for yourselves. But the key here is this, that there was something supernatural about this baby because there was a star that in some way signaled his birth. You see, in the ancient world, both with the Orientals and with the Greeks and with the Romans, all of them believed that at the birth and the deaths of great people, you could see remarkable signs in the sky if you knew how and where to look. In fact, just before Herod died, there was lunar activity. I believe it was eclipse. I have it written down in a later page of my notes. But the key is that even at his death, there was planetary action that was a little bit unusual, a little bit uncommon, and this was certainly true at the death of Christ. Something supernatural was going on, something a little beyond the ordinary, a little strange. Beyond this, of course, is the fact that Herod found out that this baby had an Old Testament prophecy written about him. But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for out of you will come a ruler who will be the shepherd of my people Israel. Even if you are a skeptic about ancient prophecies and time-worn oracles by ancient prophets and seers and mystics, there is something just the slightest bit intriguing if you see some white-haired old guy in a robe quote an old prophecy that's going to come true right now. Isn't there something just a little intriguing about that? And Herod was no doubt intrigued, not to mention the fact that all the ecclesiastical rulers under him really believed this prophecy was going to come true. And also the fact that was discomforting to Herod about this baby was that the ruler was not just called a ruler, but he would be the shepherd of God's people, Israel. That, of course, made Herod uncomfortable because not only would this person become king of the Jews, heaven's sakes, Herod was king of the Jews, but this man would not just be a despot, he would be a shepherd. The word probably almost made him nauseated with disgust that a king would consider his people with such affection that he would consider them, him, their shepherd. It's not the kind of gentleness with which Herod was used to ruling. Shepherd was an Old Testament term, and he just didn't like it. And lastly, who was this baby who made him uncomfortable? Every time in this passage, the child is mentioned in connection with his mother, the child is mentioned before the mother. In verse 11, it says, on coming to the house, the Magi saw the child with his mother. In verse 13, when they had gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. Get up, he said, take the child and his mother. Verse 14, so he got up, took the child and his mother. You see, this child is a lot more special than his mother. Maybe, just maybe, Herod begins to wonder, maybe there actually is a God. Maybe there actually is a hell. Maybe I actually will be held accountable for all these things I've done in my lifetime. It was discomforting to him, this little baby. But if the baby brought him discomfort, the people who came to worship the baby, these magi, certainly brought him discomfort as well. he was uncomfortable at Christmas time with the whole spiritual side of things, the way perhaps many people are today. Who were these Magi? This is not the primary focus of what I want to talk about today, but just briefly, Magi is just a transliteration into Greek of an Iranian word. The Greek historian Herodotus first wrote about one tribe of the Median people. Median people were closely allied to the Persians in Iran. One tribe of the Median people who were especially gifted in astronomy / astrology, because the two tended to be linked in ancient days. And so Magi were first a narrow class of people who studied the stars. Later, the term began to become applied to all the high priestly class of people in Iran, ancient Persia, because all the high priestly class studied the stars. It was true astronomy to some sense in that they really did study how the planets and stars worked, but it was also astrology because they theorized about how planetary lineups and how star configurations affected human events on Earth. So it was a little bit of the true and a little bit of the false. Now what happened is this. These people did believe in one God. They believed in the necessity of prayer. They believed in the need to live a moral life. They lived far to the east. And it's very possible that back in 722 BC, when Israel was first carried away captive by the Assyrians and scattered all around the world, that there were some Jewish people who were settled in the land of Media and in the land of Persia. Indeed, in 2 Kings 17:6, it says that when the Assyrians took the Israelites away, that the Israelites, some of them were settled in towns of the Medes. Can you picture it? Ancient Jewish people sent into exile because of their sins. And as they go, they have the Torah under their arm, weeping. And they get sent hundreds of miles away from their home. And while they're there living among the Persians, living among the Medes, they read their Bibles, and they begin to share with their Median neighbors the Old Testament prophecies. Hey, one day a Messiah is going to come, a king's going to come, he's going to rule the whole world, including you folks, and he's going to be born in Bethlehem of Judea. And so these stories get spread into Persian culture and come down through the centuries. And one day, several Persian astronomers, who are dissatisfied with their religion because they know that there's just something missing. And they remember the stories of the Old Testament prophecies that these Jews sent into exile hundreds of years earlier told of a coming Messiah one day. And one day, as they're studying the stars, they see a star that is most unusual. We don't know what this star was. There are many theories. They're not worth going into here. But something tells them this star is related to these Old Testament prophecies that these Jews from Judea talked about. And God works in these men's hearts. And they say, something is taking place here. And he draws them to leave their homes and to go many hundreds of miles and seek the king of Israel in Bethlehem. This is probably what was going on, so it seems. Maybe they had read the Old Testament prophecy in the book of Numbers, chapter 24, verse 17. It says this. Remember the prophet Balaam, the one who made the ass, whose ass spoke, and the fellow who was sent to curse Israel, but God put a spirit of blessing on him, and he blessed Israel instead. He gave this prophecy thousands of years earlier. I see him, but not near. A star will come out of Jacob, and a scepter will rise in Israel. A ruler will come out of Jacob. Maybe these Persians knew this Old Testament scripture, and they followed the Christ, and they went to extreme lengths to honor him. What did these people feel that Herod didn't have? These people had joy. It says that in verse 10, when they saw the star again leading them to Bethlehem, they were overjoyed. What did these people have that Herod didn't have? In verse 10 through 12, it says that when they saw him, they bowed down and they worshiped him. What did these people have that Herod didn't have? When they received light from God, be it ever so dim and ever so fragmented, they acted on it positively. What little light they had, they sought God more. He gave them more light. These people worshiped and gave gifts to Christ and were filled with joy. And this made Herod uncomfortable. Herod was not like this. Incidentally, just as a quick aside, when these Magi came to Jesus, I think the scriptures are clear. He was not in a manger. He was not still with the animals. Because it says, one, in verse 11, that when they entered the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary. By this time, apparently, the stable was clear. They were no longer needed to be in there, and they were in a house. And also, in Luke chapter 2, it says that Joseph and Mary days later, 40 days later, according to the Old Testament, brought Jesus to the temple after Mary's purification from her giving birth was done. That was at least 40 days later. And if Joseph and Mary had had gold from the kings, they would not have had to buy two mere pigeons or two mere doves for the sacrifice. They would have had the money to offer the full-fledged lamb, but they didn't have that. They offered the sacrifice of poor people. So the Magi had not gotten there yet, it seems, at least with 40 days. It seems that there was some time afterward, the birth of Jesus, that the Magi came. Now, I guess I just want to apply it like this at this point and ask, do zealous Christians at Christmas time ever bother you? There's a cartoon that Stayskill, the cartoonist for the Chicago Tribune for many years, drew. It's a picture of two houses together at Christmas time. And on the one house is a tiny little creche, a baby in a manger and a little tiny floodlight on it. And the next house looks like downtown Manhattan, bright lights shining and blinking and flashing and neon and Santa Claus and reindeer and Frosty the Snowman. It's all together. And the people in that house are looking aghast out the window at the people next door in their little creche, and they said, some people have to bring religion into everything. I guess the picture is half of it. But you get the point. There are people for whom the religious side of Christmas makes them very, very nervous. To see people, like wise men, going to great lengths to worship a baby born 2,000 years ago just doesn't seem reasonable. It's not dignified to get on your knees and bow down and worship a baby. And it's not dignified to be talking about religion so much when we're 20th century people who ought to know better. And to appeal to these obscure scriptures about babies born in some Judean towns and to appeal to some religious experiences that you had, it's just not where it's at. And perhaps you feel the same kind of discomfort with people who go to great lengths to worship Jesus Christ as Herod the Great did. It is because he had no idea what they were experiencing. He is like a blind man listening to someone describe colors. It just doesn't penetrate. Maybe your problem, if that is the case, is the same as Herod's problem. Because I think Herod's real problem was this. Herod was a king, and he felt his kingdom threatened by that little boy. You see, Herod had certain rights and privileges in Israel. He could do what he wanted, when he wanted, and no one told him what to do. But in this manger, it was rumored there was a king, and if there's another king, the possibility exists that that king can tell me what to do. I would like to suggest to you, if indeed the spiritual side of Christmas bothers you, it's very possible that the reason is that your personal kingdom is threatened by it. You know that if indeed that baby is God, if indeed he grew up to be the Jesus of Nazareth, who taught as he did and died as he did and rose from the dead and ascended to heaven as he did, that he demands more than a passing tip of the hat every December 25th. You know that in your heart, and that bothers you. You know that he doesn't stay a baby. If he just stayed a baby, things would be fine. But he grows up to be a king, and king of the whole universe at that. And that tends to make us uncomfortable because a king tells other people what to do. Well, how did Herod respond when he was uncomfortable with this lordly king telling him what to do? Well, the first thing he did, and the first big mistake that any person makes when confronted with Jesus Christ's kingship is this. He rejected what little light he had. Herod didn't know the whole story. He wasn't enough of a biblical student to have read all the Old Testament prophecies and put them together. He didn't realize that Jesus would be born and raised and would be a great teacher. He had no idea what he looked like or what his kingdom would look like. He did not know that Jesus' kingdom would not be one with spears and chariots. All he knew was that, quote, the king of the Jews is born in Bethlehem. And that was enough for him to check out. He did not want it. You may not understand the Bible very well this morning. It's very possible that you have merely a brushing acquaintance with it. It's possible that you have a relative, a husband, a wife, a cousin, a friend, a grandchild, who is far more acquainted with spiritual things than you, and you get most of your religion secondhand. I just want to say to you, learn from Herod here that even if you only have a tiny ray of light, don't reject that. Be very, very careful before you reject what little light you may have, because God does not require from you what you do not have. He requires from you how you act on the basis of what you do have. Having rejected what little light he had, Herod went on to become hypocritical. In verse 7, well, in verse 8, he says to the Magi, he called them back secretly, he says, and he says, go make a careful search for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me so that I too may go and worship him. And that is usually what we do when we're uncomfortable with God. First, in our hearts, we reject what little light we have and we shut it off and blacken it. And then secondly, to avoid the pressure of family and friends and other Christians in society, we play the hypocrite. We become one thing on the outside and we give due deference to him and a tip of the hat, as it were, but on the inside we know that we are not buying into it, but we pretend. That is exactly what Herod did. And if you do that today, I just say that you're following down the same path he followed, and you very possibly are going to end up with the same consequences he had. You see, he called them back for a secret meeting, it says in verse 7. This was the second time he met the Magi. And the reason it was secret, apparently, is that he did not want to blab to everyone that his true goal was to kill the child. Because everyone in Herod's court who knew him knew that if he was really going to go see the king of the Jews, that for Herod to say that I may get down on my knees and worship him just was not in tune with Herod's usual modus operandi. In other words, the cat would be out of the bag that he was going to slit the little rascal's throat. And so he did it in secret. That's why he did it. He became a hypocrite. And lastly, what he did is this. Understand this. Herod tried to kill God. If this man were a king, and if he had God's stamp on him, Herod was going to kill him. Many people have objected and say this is not so. For Herod to try to kill the baby, and later when he found out he was tricked to try to kill all these innocent little babies in Bethlehem, nobody would go and order the slaughter of, what, 15, 20, 30 little babies, 2-year-old and under, in a little town of Bethlehem. But I want you to know that Herod was very capable of this. Just to give you an example of the many murders he committed in his lifetime, I told you about his second wife, Miriam, the beautiful Jewish princess. Herod became king in 37 B.C. In 35 B.C., he murdered Miriam's 18-year-old brother. He had him drowned. In 30 B.C., he murdered Miriam's grandfather. In 29 B.C., he suspected her of adultery and had her throttled. In 20 B.C., he murdered Miriam's mother. In 8 B.C., he murdered her and his two sons. And 5 days before his birth, he ordered the murder of another son, all because he was afraid these people were claimants to his throne. Do you see why he would think it nothing to murder 20 little baby boys in Bethlehem? These people, one of them, just might be God's son and take over where I left off. Do you see why all Jerusalem was disturbed, as it says in verse 3? Because they knew that when Herod gets upset, heads roll and blood flows and things begin to happen. The Bible makes it clear that in our hearts, we are naturally hostile toward God. That if we could do, if we had the power to do as we truly wanted to do, each of us in our hearts would kill God, if possible. It says in the book of Jeremiah that men's hearts are extremely wicked, and the wickedness is so deep that no man can even know the wickedness of his own heart. That if God were a man standing in front of us and could be killed and we had a gun, that in our natural state, if no one knew, if there would be no consequences, if the word would not get out, and if we would not feel personal guilt, that the thought to rid ourselves of God always telling us what to do would be a wonderful thought for most of us, and that we're more capable of it than we think. We are not so different from Herod. How did it end for him? Well, you need to know that Herod died probably within just a few weeks of months of this event, as you put all the chronology together. Herod, in the last weeks of his life, was so tormented with the guilt of all the murders he had committed and all the political crimes that he was guilty of, that he walked up and down his palace holding his head and screaming in agony. He slept fitfully and he screamed in his sleep, walking the gates of his palace like a madman, tormented, plagued, insane, bothered, lying at the very gates of death, knowing that its jaws were going to open and he deserved it more than anyone in history. I think probably the most powerful three words in this whole chapter come in verse 19, the first three words in the New International Version. After Herod died, an angel told Mary and Joseph they could bring Jesus back. The key is this: Herod died. Just like every man and woman is going to die. Incidentally, he died a very painful, terrible death. The diagnosis is uncertain, but he writhed in pain, and it was very terrible. He writhed in pain. The key is this: that the man who rejected God on his deathbed felt the guilt of a man who has lived a life of rejecting God, and he knew that things were not going to go well for him when he ended. Chris Kiley, are you out in the back? Could you just come in a second? I just asked Chris if she would just choose one child, boy, two or under. I don't even know who she has. Chris, could you come inside, please? And just bring him in, or several, because I just wanted you to see the nature of the children that, well, I see we have some girls, too. That's really not the point. That's fine. The key is, these were the aged children that Herod had his men slaughter. I just want you to look at them for a minute. Let them walk around, maybe come up front and then walk down that aisle. That would be great. Hi there, kids. Could you come this way? Mr. Kiley, could you raise your hand and make sure they go down that aisle? Do you see the hideousness of sin? That to protect his throne would cause a man to slit the throats of people that age. Now, you may say to yourself as I close this: how could God have let little babies like that be killed instead of his son? Why would God let that happen? All the mothers of Bethlehem surely must have been wondering, if they knew what was going on, God, why did you let my little baby become the ram in the thicket while Isaac gets away? The great commentators Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, I think, say it so powerfully. They say something to this effect: oh, mothers, I do not know why it is that your baby should be, as it were, caught in the thicket to be the sacrifice as a ram while Isaac gets away. But I want to say this, he says: a number of you mothers will still be living 33 years from now when that baby becomes the ram caught in a thicket and your little Isaac escapes. You see, the point is this: even those little innocent babies that were murdered, those little children that walk through here, the Bible makes clear they're born with sin. They inherited a sinful nature from Adam, and as soon as they're old enough to deliberately sin, they will do so. That even little babies need a savior. There is no such thing as a slaughter of the innocents, because in the deepest sense of the term, there is no one innocent. We're all born with a sinful nature, and we all ratify that with our own acts every single day as soon as we're old enough. And these children need a savior like anyone. And the 33 years later, this baby who escaped would face a fate far more terrible than they. He would endure, in the space of 3 or 4 hours, an eternity of hell. And they would escape a fate far worse than would be theirs after death if they had not had a Savior. You see, in heaven, if indeed the Savior has paid the price for these babies' sins, I think these babies will be honored that God allowed them to be the substitute so that his son could get away to live long enough to become a substitute for them. So I close by saying this: if Herod had only known what this baby was like, if Herod had known that this king was going to be a servant king, not to just rule with a rod of iron and make people miserable, but that he himself would be a servant to everyone he rules. If Herod had known that all the good things in his life that he enjoyed, the wine he drank, the food he ate, the wives he loved, the scenery he saw, the skill of architecture to build these beautiful palaces if he had only known that that baby is who had given all those things to him. If Herod had only known that God intended men to rule, that indeed God would make men and women kings in heaven over large tracts of area. If Herod had only known that his guilt that he had spent a lifetime incurring could be erased by that very baby. If Herod had only known that the only way he could enjoy his riches was to have his guilt erased and be conscience-free because of what that baby would one day do. If Herod could have only known that murder could be forgiven because of that baby. If Herod could only have known that his life, which would be snuffed out within weeks, could possibly be eternal life because of that baby. If Herod had only known that he could reign with Christ in heaven forever, how different would his reaction have been? And how different would your reaction be if only you had known?